This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare.
Where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey.
Serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England.
Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETSurvey.com. That's DoucetSurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. You're listening to a violin concerto by the minimalist composer Philip Glass, widely acknowledged as one of the late 20th century's most influential music makers. He's worked with artists, musicians, and filmmakers from David Bowie to Woody Allen, and famously collaborated with the theater director Robert Wilson on the landmark opera Einstein on the Beach in 1976. Even after Einstein, Glass did not quit his day job as a New York cabbie and sometime plumber. In fact, he was once called to install a dishwasher at the Soho loft of a very shocked Robert Hughes, who was then Time magazine's art critic. Clay Wirestone is arts editor for the Concord Monitor and a contributor to Mental Floss, where we found a list of 11 celebrated artists who did not quit their day job. Great to have you back, Clay.
It's good to be back, Virginia.
So the trajectory is usually you work at some kind of menial job until you hit it big, then you quit, and then you're a full-blown artist. Why do you think these artists did not?
Well, I think that's the stereotype. But I think being an artist, either a writer or a visual artist or a composer, they're not all known for necessarily being the most lucrative professions. And a lot of people simply want to have lives, you know, they want to have homes and spouses and, you know, not have to scrape by month to month. So I think there's a real attraction to that steady gig, whatever it is.
What do we know about Philip Glass? He wasn't just a plumber, but a cabbie. How long did he do it? And do you have any idea why he chose?
Well, for Philip Glass, I think it was really a matter of survival. I mean, he was working in New York City in the 1960s and 1970s, and he was working in a field where it was a very much an underground emerging field. And for someone like him, who came from a working class background, I believe his dad ran a music store, he did whatever it took to make ends meet. And for him, that meant working as a plumber, that meant driving a cab. He actually kept his cabbie's license and was driving the cab into his 40s. It was only at the age of 42 that he decided not to renew the cabbie's license. He thought, well, maybe this music thing is making me enough money now to support me.
And over across the pond, T.S. Eliot, most well known for his modernist masterpiece, The Wasteland. Writing was not the only thing that occupied his time. What was Eliot's other job?
Well, he actually had a couple. During the writing of The Wasteland, for about 8 years from the 1917 to 1925, he worked for the bank, Lloyd's of London. He worked in their foreign accounts business. He was very well liked. People thought he did a great job. But his friends, led by the fellow poet Ezra Pound, were really kind of aghast that he was punching the clock like this. They actually put together a collection and raised money to give him the equivalent of his bank's salary for some 5 years if he would just quit the darn bank job and go into writing and criticism full time. And Eliot actually turned them down because, as he saw it, why would he just take 5 years of security when he had potentially a career's worth of security in the lucrative banking sector? And even after he did leave the bank in 1925, it was only to go to another full-time job, which was at the prestigious publisher Faber & Faber, where he was an editor and actually then worked 9-to-5 for another 40 years.
Well, it's a wonder that when maintaining full-time jobs, so many of these people can actually produce anything. In fact, you write about Toni Morrison, who had a strategy. She just got up really early in the morning.
Exactly. Well, Toni Morrison, like Eliot in his later career, Toni Morrison was an editor, and she worked for Random House for some 20 years and was also a single mom with two kids. For the first part of her writing career, at least, she had to get up before 5 every morning because she said that's when her kids got up. And actually, this is also interesting. After she finally left her job at Random House, she said it took her a couple of years to figure out just how to be not so busy all the time, to actually find the space to be calm and to write and without having this constant job, constant work kind of deadlines around her.
Yeah, that's what we imagine, that you have to have some calm, some place of quiet. But I think of the poets Wallace Stevens. He was an insurance man in Hartford, Connecticut.
Exactly.
And William Carlos Williams, who remained in his practice as a pediatrician. Now, did either of them ever talk about why they stayed in their day jobs?
Well, I think for Wallace Stevens, it was actually mainly money. I mean, I think insurance is one of the more lucrative fields that people could be in, and he actually is working for what people know as the Hartford now. It's a still continuing, surviving insurance company. He also was a very ordered, Wallace Stevens was a very ordered and very routine-oriented guy. He didn't have a car. He would walk to work every morning and actually compose poetry in his head. When he got to his office, it was about a 2-mile walk, he would then make sure that he got it all down, and then he'd go about his work. For someone like William Carlos Williams, who I think is in many ways one of the greatest examples of this, he found direct inspiration in his life for his work. He was very interested in capturing kind of colloquial speech, how real people talked. And as a pediatrician for some 40 years in Rutherford, New Jersey, he really talked about that as being one of his sources of inspiration. He heard people at their high points, at their low points, and he heard how people actually spoke. He also used those experiences as a doctor in writing prose. He published a book that was called The Doctor Stories that was, you know, a collection of kind of vignettes based on his experiences.
Any other artists that you can think of that actually found inspiration from their workaday jobs?
In the case of Bram Stoker, who's really well known for writing, of course, the horror masterpiece Dracula, he had written before, but he was kind of a theater critic, and he came to the attention of Sir Henry Irving, who was an English actor of the era. Irving hired Stoker to be his personal manager and to look after a theater of his called the Lyceum in the West End of London. But for Stoker, kind of coming into that creative milieu of being around all of these famous and kind of outrageous personalities, it led him to write and publish his first horror story and to then start kind of a trajectory of works and publishing that led to Dracula in 1897 when that book came out. And it was a huge hit, and he actually still kept working for Irving for another 7 years until his benefactor died.
You also tell the story of the sculptor Richard Serra. Now, this is a sculptor who does these massive, like the size of ship's hulls, almost like often round concentric sculptures. He actually founded a company employing a number of his New York City artist mm-hmm. friends. In fact, he was a contemporary of Philip Glass at that point. What were they doing?
Well, the company was called Low Rate Movers. They basically had a single van, and the way that Serra put it was the various people that he worked with, they would share the van and each would only have to work 2 or 3 days a week. But what's great is that the people that he brought into Low Rate Movers were Chuck Close, the painter, Spalding Gray, who became known as a monologist and actor, and Philip Glass, who apparently just really liked to work. And yeah, and he just said it was really the ideal situation because they were able to collaborate and then also find the time to go off and do their creative projects, you know, on their own terms.
Well, this one really threw me. Kurt Vonnegut also worked as a car dealer. I mean, some of the other jobs I see as a little more sort of creative. I suppose car dealership is creative.
I think Kurt Vonnegut actually wanted to be someone like Wallace Stevens or somebody who would make a lot of money and then be able to write on the side, because Vonnegut had already been known at this point as a science fiction writer. He'd published stories, science fiction stories. He'd published his first novel. But he really thought that, well, maybe I can find some sort of regular gig that will bring in a little more cash. So he started a car dealer in 1957 called Saab Cape Cod, which was just complicated by the fact that the Saabs of the era were really terrible, terrible cars. He wrote a really funny little essay about it in 2004, just talking about the fact that Saabs of the era, you essentially had to put in oil each time that you refilled the car, something he said that, quote, something that most straight women were unwilling to do. And actually ended up closing the dealership kind of within the year. He then suggested that it was his bad experience with Saab that was the reason that the Swedes had never awarded him a Nobel Prize for literature.
Clay Wirestone, arts editor for the Concord Monitor, also a contributor to Mental Floss. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
There's a link to Clay's full list of celebrated artists who did not quit their day jobs at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, you thought teaching math was tough? Try doing it without speaking. We'll hear about a man who uses mime to teach mathematics when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. By the end of high school, most students have had their fill of math. But teacher Tim Chartier is convincing his pupils to give things like fractions and partial derivatives one last try. Reporter Ari Daniel has the story.
I have a confession to make. I love math. I minored in it in college. I would have taken more math classes if I could have fit them into my schedule. And these days, one of my favorite things to do as a reporter is to talk to people who get to love math for a living.
It corresponds to a partial derivative. That's telling you the rate of change.
People like Tim Chartier. He's a mathematician at Davidson College in North Carolina. And there are two things that set this guy apart from a lot of mathematicians. First, he cares a lot about getting others to care about math.
I really enjoy teaching those last math class of your life classes, where often a large percentage of the students really would rather not take the class. It's not even that. They hate math, but they have to take the class. On the first day of class, I turn to the class and I say, you may have never had a positive experience in math in your life. Well, we have 16 weeks for you to have one.
So that's the first thing you need to know about Chartier. The other thing is that he's a professional mime.
I'm a mime and a mathematician. I mean, what the heck is that?
And even farther out on the what the heck spectrum is that for the last decade, Chartier has been combining his two loves in a performance genre he calls mimatics. It's mime about mathematics.
People don't have a good view of either one, and I'm insane enough to put them together.
And I'm insane enough to make a radio story about it. I mean, doing a story on the radio about math is hard enough, and doing one on mime is practically impossible. So this piece is going to take some work. Case in point, this is the sound of Tim Chartier performing. See what I mean? Not very helpful. So let me explain what's going on. I found this sketch on Chartier's video reel on the web. It's about remainders and division. Chartier shuffles on stage in a rimmed hat and a clown nose, carrying a piece of luggage. He's not wearing white makeup on his face, and yes, he is using props. You might be thinking, that's not mime, but there are actually different types of mime. Chartier places the suitcase on a table and pulls out three miniature plungers. He makes them interact with one another. One of them competes for the affections of the other two, which leads to some plunger smooching, then jealousy and fighting, and a plunger version of CPR. I have to say that watching Chartier parade these little plungers around, it looks as though they're alive. He pulls out a fourth plunger, and he forms two pairs. All the plungers are happy now. Until Chartier reaches back into the suitcase, eventually pulling out nine more plungers for a total of 13 on the table. He forms two groups of six, but there's one left over. Chartier looks sad about this. So he regroups them. But no matter what he does with his 13 plungers, regrettably, he's always left with one. 13 is a prime number. Then, at the very end of the sketch, the 13th plunger whispers something into Chartier's ear. He returns to the suitcase one last time, reaches in, and pulls out a toilet brush. The 13th plunger is in love, and Chartier, satisfied at last, shuffles off stage. So this sketch is a story about remainders. It has characters. Hearts are broken, new relationships are formed, and the audience can relate to what's happening on stage.
By infusing that emotional content to it, we can have that in life. We don't want to be the remainder. People fight over the remainder. If you and I split up a cake, maybe we really shouldn't split it in half. Well, why not? That's fair. Not if I really want the slice with my name on it.
It's tough to make a sketch like this, where the math is right and the mime is tight. So tough that for a long time, it didn't even occur to Chartier to try it. He'd always kept his math and his mime separate, and he excelled at both. He got a PhD in applied mathematics, and he trained with the international mime legend Marcel Marceau. But then, in 2002, after finishing up his doctorate, he got a call from Boulder, Colorado. The library there had just received a grant to put on math-related performances, and they asked him,
would you be willing to be part of these math performances? And I was like, oh, well, I don't do math performances. I'm not sure what you're thinking. Oh, you could do your mime show. And I was entirely taken off guard and almost defensive about it. It was like, what are you talking about? It's not a math show. Oh, but there are wonderful math moments in this thing. I remember, I was like, oh, give me a break. I mean, come on.
But when he mentioned this conversation to his wife, Tanya, who's also his mime partner, she didn't even blink.
I could see that it could be done. And so I said to Tim, yeah, I think it's clearly a mathematical component. So maybe he needed it pointed out to think about it in a different way.
Tim was hesitant at first, but finally he said, okay, let's try it. He and Tanya went through their entire act, honing the sketches that already had a mathy flavor and jettisoning the ones that didn't. And they added new ones intentionally rooted in math, like the plunger sketch. And since that performance in Boulder a decade ago, the Chartiers have managed to maintain their careers and a family while at the same time touring all over the world with their Mimatics show. They're in real demand. They've performed for audiences that range from 20 to over 3,000, from assemblies for kids to conferences for adults.
Math is inherently, in many of its forms, invisible. So I think that using the art form of mime makes the invisible quality of math visible in a way that feels both exciting and natural to a mathematician.
A mathematician like Darren Glass. He's chair of the math department at Gettysburg College.
Yes, I think it's a lot of fun. Mathematicians, we scribble on pieces of paper, on chalkboard, we get used to it, and here he is enacting these ideas and these pictures that we have in our heads.
I spoke with Glass at a conference on recreational mathematics in New York City. Tim and Tanya were there performing some of their sketches before a crowd of 100 people. Children strained out of their seats to see what was going to happen next. They loved it, and the grown-ups loved it. This is a sketch that deals with topology, the study of geometric properties and spatial relations unaffected by the continuous change of shape or size of figures. Obviously. Tim conceals himself inside a large silver slinky tube. It's an industrial-sized dryer vent. Tanya approaches the tube cautiously at first, but then she gets more playful with it, and the tube begins taking on different shapes. It forms an upside-down U, then a periscope, then the letter O. It even steals Tanya's hat, like a hungry elephant trunk. A moment later, it burps it back out.
All right, we're going to tie back into thinking about what does this have to do with mathematics? So let's think
at various points throughout the show, the Chartiers break their mimey vow of silence for a minute to go over the math inside some of their segments verbally. But then it's back to miming. The Chartiers move through sketch after sketch, each one containing a different math concept, everything from geometric projections to infinity. The closer is the plunger sketch. Afterwards, I wander through the audience to see what they thought of the show.
You know, I wouldn't have thought that I liked mime, but actually I was just kind of blown away by what they did.
You must have friends that don't like math. Do you think that this would be a good kind of gateway drug for them?
Absolutely, absolutely.
I just enjoyed seeing math being performed on the stage, bringing mathematics to a wider audience.
If you're introducing humor and joy and excitement about math and mime, two things that people generally don't like, then you've done your job.
But not everybody loved it.
It was just not enough math for me to, like, think that it's good.
You wanted more math.
Yes, because it's a math conference, so.
Ron Lancaster feels the same way. He teaches math education at the University of Toronto.
Throughout parts of it, I was trying to figure out where the math was, and I was struggling with that.
So for you, what would have really made it is if maybe they spent a little bit more time talking about how each sketch connected to certain math concepts.
That would have helped me immensely.
Tim Chartier doesn't mind the criticism because most folks who see the show aren't math experts. The idea is to give those people a foothold, a way into the world of math.
My goal in Mimatics is to create a seed that can grow to allow you to delve into mathematics. A very active goal for us is that we are not performing at you. You are not simply sitting back and watching us. You are part of our performance. The way you laugh, the energy, the way that you respond, you can feel us performing in a different way because of you there. Your true performing is when the audience shares that journey with you. Marcel Marceau would say, you lift them to another place. And when you take them to another place, they do not forget you.
Which gets back to Chartier's ultimate goal, giving people a positive math experience for once. The reason mimetics works, he says, is because good mime is inherently transportive. And while the audience is suspended in that other place, their minds are primed to take in new ideas, math ideas. Math might involve numbers and proofs, but it also takes a lot of imagination, just like mime. In fact, Chartier says that working with both makes him better at both, in life and in the show.
My greatest gift is in living in these two worlds, mime and math. With mime that's generally made fun of and math that people generally don't like, then it's almost the fact that it's so unexpected that it penetrates even further. They're not separate for me. It's me. It's how I operate. So what do you love? How different are they? No matter how different they are, you are the intersection of those. So find a way to embrace that intersection.
In other words, find a way to love all of yourself and then declare it to the world as loudly as you can. Or, in Chartier's case, by hardly saying anything at all. I'm Ari Daniel.
Coming up, a conversation with the jazz vibraphonist and 7-time Grammy Award winner, Gary Burton. That's after a quick break.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Gary Burton was 13 when he first heard jazz. By then, he'd been playing the marimba for 7 years and had toured around his home state of Indiana and as far as Miami with his siblings. The Burton Family Band came apart shortly after Gary heard this. Benny Goodman's band doing After You've Gone. That song helped launch a career that has spanned the globe, the decades, collaborations with musicians from Chick Corea to Astor Piazzolla, and originated what is called the Burton Grip, playing the vibraphone holding 2 mallets in each hand. Today, Gary Burton is a 7-time Grammy Award winner and has spent most of his life playing and teaching jazz. We spoke to him when his autobiography, Learning to Listen, was first released. It's now available in paperback. Do you remember what you thought when you first heard that record, that Benny Goodman track?
Yeah, and just hearing a little of it now really took me back. What I always remembered was just the kind of excitement that it offered. I'd never heard anything like that before. And I thought, wow, this is such a great beat, and it's got a great feeling. I want to find out what this music is all about. And from then on, I was hooked.
Now, before hearing that record, you were growing up in a small town, Indiana, not a place I imagine a lot of marimba or vibraphone players. How did you pick up the instrument?
The truth is, I didn't pick it. My parents did. They wanted all 3 of the kids in the family to have music lessons, and my older sister had already started on piano. And when I was about 6, they decided it was time for me to have an instrument. And they looked around, and there happened to be a lady in the area who played marimba and vibraphone and gave lessons. So that's how I came to get started. They took me over to meet her, and she became my teacher for the first, for a couple of years, more or less. And then we moved to the other end of the state of Indiana, and that was the end of the lessons. And I discovered then that instead of my instrument being, you know, universally recognized and available, that, in fact, it was a very rare instrument, and you know, most people didn't even know what it meant when you say, I play the vibraphone.
Well, let's listen to where you've gotten to since. This is a track called Jane Fonda Called Again. It's off of the Gary Burton Quartet's new album, Guided Tour.
Thank you.
Jane Fonda called again off the new Gary Burton Quartet's new album, Guided Tour. Does Jane Fonda often call?
No. And I, of course, don't know her at all. It just seemed like a funny phrase. I saw it in a magazine. And I often get ideas for song titles from ad copy and, you know, lines that you'll see in magazine stories and so on. And somewhere in some magazine, I was reading like a People magazine that's full of great title possibilities. And there was Jane Fonda called again. And I said, that's a great song title. I've got to find the right song for it. And that was the one.
Gary, you're known for what is called the Burton grip. In fact, it's playing with two mallets at the same time on the vibraphone. How did you develop the technique?
I grew up in a small farm town and I played alone most of the time. And it sounded very incomplete. I wanted some harmony and more chords and sounds to fill out the music somewhat. So I started, playing with four and gradually got more dexterity with it. And at a certain point, decided that the more traditional way of holding the mallets was kind of awkward. And I experimented and found what for me and for many other players nowadays, it's turned out, is a more comfortable and convenient way of holding them. And even though I didn't name it the Burton grip, it became eventually known as my grip. And it's the most widely used technique for manipulating four mallets these days. And I'm sure the thing I'll be most remembered for over the passage of many years will not be that great solo I played on that record or whatever. It will be, that's the guy that played with four sticks. So that's my fate, I think.
Well, let's hear about some of those collaborations. This is one of your pioneering works of jazz rock. This is your first as a band leader, and the record is called Duster. The track is General Mojo's Well-Laid Plan. Gary, this is a few years before the album that's considered to be a landmark in jazz rock, Miles Davis's Bitches Brew. Did you know what you were embarking on at this time?
Well, I did and I didn't. I didn't know if it would necessarily become a genre in its own right. I just knew it was something that I wanted to try musically. And I was being pretty calculating about it. And I realized that most of the people I played for were twice my age. I was in my early 20s in those years, and the audiences were in their 40s and older. And just doing the math, you realize that, by the time I'm 40, they'll be 80, and they won't be coming to jazz clubs much to see me. So I wanted to connect with my own age group if I could. And I also asked myself, what do I like? What do I listen to? And I was at the time really enthralled with the new rock that had arrived, the Beatles and Bob Dylan. Rock used to be pretty boring for musicians. And, we make fun of all the tunes that only had three chords to them and so on. But here came rock musicians that were playing much more sophisticated music with, adding things like string quartets and Indian sitars and different things. So I was very interested in this, and it just seemed like the ideal, choice for me. I wanted to do something different, something youthful, and there it was just sort of staring me in the face. By 1970, the genre had changed its name to jazz fusion and was often rolling, particularly after Miles joined. At the first, we were considered heretics because rock was the enemy. stealing audience from the jazz musicians. And people would even say to me, why are you doing this? It's wrong. That's the last thing jazz people should be doing, is using rock elements. But I was drawn to it, and the audiences liked it as well, I discovered. So once that happens, you're encouraged to keep on.
And now you're the 70-year-old, right?
Right.
Gary Burton, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Gary Burton's autobiography, Learning to Listen, The Jazz Journey of Gary Burton, is now available in paperback. There's more information on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Up next, a conversation with the comedian Todd Glass. He's been performing stand-up since 1982, but made his boldest move just a few years ago when he came out publicly as gay on Marc Maron's podcast, WTF. We'll speak with Todd Glass when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Sarah Silverman considers him one of her favorite comedians of all time. Jim Gaffigan says he is the funniest person he knows. And Patton Oswalt describes him as a human hurricane and comedic force of nature. Although Todd Glass has been performing stand-up since 1982, he made his boldest move in the business when he came out publicly as gay on Marc Maron's podcast WTF in January of 2012.
What's up, Todd?
How you doing?
No, I just wanted to come on and promote my podcast.
Oh,
Glass Show.
I had no idea that's what we were doing.
Oh, yeah. What did you think?
Oh, I thought you were gay.
Oh, are you shitting me?
Yeah, is that weird?
Oh, my God,
I'm sorry.
Oh, my God. Did you really think that?
Yeah.
Why?
Because we had these phone calls.
All right, let's cut the shit here. Yeah.
He expands on that groundbreaking moment in his book, The Todd Glass Situation, a bunch of lies about my personal life and a bunch of true stories about my 30-year career in stand-up comedy. We spoke to Todd Glass for the release of his autobiography. The book is now available in paperback. At the beginning of this book, you write about suffering a heart attack. You're backstage at a comedy club. You were 45 years old then. You tried to fix yourself by quitting smoking and losing weight. You actually waited 2 years to come out publicly. So what, if not that, finally drove you to do it?
Well, you would think that the heart attack did it, but I thought it would. I realized when the heart attack happened, I thought 2 days afterwards I would start being much more honest in a quicker way, not 1 year telling people. When I was in the ambulance, I yelled out to Sarah Silverman because I knew she had to call the person I had been in a relationship with for a long time, but I didn't want to say a guy's name. So I yelled out and I went, Sarah, call Andrea. Andrea. And she knew Andrea was code for Chris. Mm-hmm. And I remember there, even laying there while having a heart attack, going, this is so pathetic. It's so pathetic. Even a little bit laughing at myself, because, if it's pathetic, it can sometimes be funny, especially if you're aware of it. And I went, what am I doing? What am I doing? And then it took me about a year and a half after that to finally go, okay, it's time to, like, just be honest about who I am. And, of course, life, I didn't know it would get better, but it got better. It did get much better. It's like that weight off the shoulders. You think you know what that means. You're like, oh, yeah, weight off your shoulders. You have something on your mind. You get it off. But once it happens, it's like, oh my God, this feels so much better.
Marc writes the introduction to your new book and says he didn't suspect at all. I mean, he had no idea. And many people didn't. You told a handful of people, maybe 15 people, your family, your close friends. Nobody suspected.
Well, my close friends knew, even if I didn't tell them, but people around me all the time, like a lot of comedians, I know they were, and they didn't care. And I think there's a lot of people from a loving place that might say something like, from a loving place, but also confused, like, what? Why is he hiding it? Nobody cares. Mm. Know that a lot of those people, including me, knew that inwardly. But we didn't start hiding today. For me, it started when I was 13 years old. And then the lie perpetuates and perpetuates. And at one point, you get comfortable in the lie. Mm.
In your act, you even fabricated a girlfriend. Here's a clip of one of your jokes. This is from the 2008 Just for Laughs Gala in Montreal.
My neighbor smells. My girlfriend wants me to tell him he smells, but I don't want to hurt his feelings. She goes, tell him creatively. And how is that? What do you say creatively? You go, hey, is your ass backed up? Chew the nail. Now your ass isn't backed up. That's cool. Are you sure? No.
So aside from the fake girlfriend, how authentic was that? Was it drawn from a real experience?
So I love the way you asked that question, because most people just say to me in interviews, oh, that's so sad that you had to make up a girlfriend and make up a story. And I go, whoa, I made up that it was a girl, but I didn't make up the story, which indirectly proves something, which I never thought I was out proving it, but I did. You know, people wonder, what is the difference between same-sex relationships versus guy-girl, guy-guy, what's the difference, you know? There is no difference, because every time I told those stories on stage, I was in a relationship with a guy. But when I switched it and told it to audiences, never once did they go, that's weird, because it's the same exact thing. The only way the audience would have figured it out that was different if I said, I was in the bathroom at the airport and I was going to the bathroom next to my girlfriend. And they'd be like, wait a second, what airport bathroom does this guy use?
Well, I guess reading your book, I really enjoyed reading about your early life. I wanted to say you moved, I think, 5 times in 8 years, or maybe 8 times in 5 years. I may have that.
Yeah, we moved a lot.
But that gave me some perspective on the outsider. You were dyslexic, ADHD. You were Jewish in these predominantly WASPy neighborhoods, and gay. So you must have grown up thinking, wow, I'm just out of it on all counts.
You know what? I don't want to make it look like woe is me, because I had a really good life. My parents were awesome. My people that surrounded me. I'm not trying to get up on a podium, and because I do a lot of wrong things in my life and I make a lot of mistakes. But where I try to be decent, I guess it comes from sitting around so long and hearing people not say anything. And we lived in a neighborhood where I would hear people make like sort of homophobic comments, and they weren't egregious. They weren't like F this group or F that group. They were like things at a dinner table or at a Thanksgiving dinner table, and nobody said anything.
But you said a lot when you were growing up, apparently, talking all the time, entertaining your teachers, started performing stand-up in high school. Was there a moment when you thought, I'm going to be a comedian, that's it?
Well, comedy for me, and I like all types of comedy, like some silly comedy growing up, hearing Steve Martin did it for me, but I also like comedy that is social, he has something to say, or politically. And for comedians, that was what I understood. When George Carlin talked about it, I got it. So I always really loved stand-up comedy. And then when I was in high school, we started going to this club. Now, a lot of the guys like that I'll mention now, they weren't as famous as they are now. But we would go see people at this place called the Comedy Works. We'd see like Jerry Seinfeld, Gary Shandling, Paul Reiser, Jay Leno, Jerry Seinfeld, you know, Richard Lewis, Gilbert Godfrey. The list would just go Stephen Wright, Eddie Murphy, Roseanne Barr. So I saw a lot of really good comedy, and I loved it. I mean, I didn't just like it. I'm not exaggerating, fell in love with stand-up comedy. I went every single week, and then I heard those infamous words. Hey, if you think you're funny, Wednesday night's open mic night. And there it all started.
I'm speaking with the stand-up comedian Todd Glass. He's been in the business for more than 30 years and regularly appears on shows like Jimmy Kimmel Live. In 2012, he shook the comedy world when he came out publicly as gay on the WTF podcast. We're talking with him about his new book, The Todd Glass Situation. Stand-up comedy requires risk-taking. You deal with hecklers and rejection and instability of life on the road. On top of that, you started comedy in the early 80s. Now, this is right when the AIDS crisis hit the U.S. Homophobia and misinformation about how it was spread was just rampant at that time. How did you deal with that in your circles, both on stage and off?
You know, that's why I'm very careful in the jokes that I make today. You know, in comedy, I think a lot of times when I speak about comedy, some people misunderstand me. And I hope this leads back to answering your question, which I think it will. As far as like, you don't want to offend people. Look, you have to offend people. You just hope you're offending the right people. But back then, there were a lot of jokes about just, you know, about AIDS and about, you know, can you imagine two guys? And man, it did not help. Plus, the way people threw around the word, you know, gay, gay, faggot, gay, and all instead of saying lame. So then you have to say to yourself later, like, I have to come out, and a word that I've heard used as lame for 25 years, think just lame, lame, gay, gay, gay. Now you have to tell people I'm gay. So, you know, yeah, back then it was very scary to, as a comedian, it did not lead a path for me to come out. So again, going back to your original question, you know, like, that's why it was hard, you know, when a lot of people go, what's he afraid of? Hey, go back to 1982. That's where I started, you know, really being in the closet.
Mm-hmm. And being backstage with people and having conversations about, would you drink out of the same glass as a gay person drank out of?
Yeah, and by the way, that conversation was not from a bunch of morons. I remember hearing those conversations, and it was from pretty evolved people that were confused about it. Hey, they had to have the conversation, but I heard that. And that really went, oh my God, like, that really penetrated, and it really made me, you know, just say, okay, this is not something I want to share with anybody.
Well, here's one of your friends and a very evolved person, Louis C.K. This is from a 2008 routine. Just want to warn listeners that he does use some of those barbed words we were just speaking to Todd about.
I miss that word, you know. I grew up saying that word, and it never meant gay. When I was a kid, I don't know what gay was. No, I hadn't been told that people do that. I had no idea. Faggot didn't mean gay. When I was a kid, you called somebody faggot because they're being a faggot, you know?
Louis C.K. from his 2008 stand-up special called Chewed Up. Listening to that clip from Louis C.K., now you admit that even you have a hard time saying the word gay. Why is that?
Yeah, well, I'm a very big Louis C.K. fan, and I understand what he's saying about that joke, and I don't know if I totally disagree with it. It's where you take it from that point on. I think when some people hear that joke, they might misunderstand that he's saying it's okay to use it, and I'm not sure exactly what he's saying, but when somebody uses a word as an adjective, like, you know, someone's being as an adjective, it's that simple. Instead of saying clumsy, some people say retarded, and you're like, no, just use the adjective. Don't make someone's being a negative adjective. You have to see how that's bad. I don't think they did anything wrong, and it's a funny way I'm saying it, but it'll make a twist. Nobody using the word gay as an adjective did anything wrong at all. But once someone makes you privy to that word does have a path to causing someone pain, you didn't think it did. That's why you didn't do anything wrong. But now, once someone makes you aware of it, yeah, I was a 12-year-old kid. And if you have your headphones on or you're listening to this interview right now and you can't say to yourself, oh, I guess that would suck that your being meant lame, that your being, and I'm repeating it, meant lame. If you can't go inward and go, oh, I didn't know it and I didn't do anything wrong, but now I do know it and I choose to keep using that word, I really do wonder about that person, because I don't know how to rattle you out of saying that word. You know, if what I just said doesn't make you go, oh, that makes total sense, I'm going to stop that.
Some of the best comedy does require rigorous, unguarded honesty. I think about Richard Pryor, you know, joking about setting himself on fire while freebasing cocaine, or Louis C.K. talking about raising kids as a single parent. Now, do you think remaining closeted kept you from being truly funny? And in other words, was there a part of you censoring yourself?
At first, I thought it didn't. I thought, well, I'm not honest about my relationships, but I am honest about so many other things, and I don't talk about relationships that much. But then afterwards, I realized, yes, it did, because I would keep anything out of my act that wasn't perceived to be manly. I like lighting a certain way when I go into a room. I don't like it light. I like it dark. I don't like cooking because I don't have the patience, but I like the look of a set table. I like the look of when you're having a big dinner and there's like 15 people and it's set. I set the table the night before. I used to be afraid to talk about that on stage because I thought, well, that doesn't seem manly. So maybe, hey, look, I'll be confident. Maybe I was a good comic, but I can take it to another level now. You know, the more honest you are on stage, yes, obviously that's what makes a better comic.
Well, Todd Glass, what a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
You know what? It was a very enjoyable conversation. I appreciate you having me on.
Todd Glass is a stand-up comedian and author of the book The Todd Glass Situation, a bunch of lies about my personal life and a bunch of true stories about my 30-year career in stand-up comedy. If you'd like to hear more from Todd, you'll find a link to his podcast, The Todd Glass Show, at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There's much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show, you can catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org or by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, please tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow, too, with more Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray,
with help from our intern,
Katie McAuliffe. The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.